Welcome to SCOTUS Cast. On June 25, 2007, the U.S. Supreme Court delivered its decision on the Wilkie v. Robbins case. The case involved officials of the Bureau of Land Management's regulatory responsibilities in attempting to obtain a reciprocal right-of-way across private property intermingled with public lands. In this episode of SCOTUS Cast, Gary Lawson, a professor at Boston University Law School, offers his analysis of the recent decision. Tim Sandifer, an attorney at Pacific Legal, offers his own analysis in another edition of SCOTUS Cast. As always, the Federalist Society itself takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Gary Lawson.
Lord Acton once said, "Power tends to corrupt." What happens when that power held by government agents tends to corrupt them in a way that makes them overreach their responsibilities and harass private citizens? One possible answer, going back to ringing language from Marbury versus Madison, is that for every wrong, there must be a remedy. But every first-year law student knows that that is not the case. Doctrines of unreviewability place certain kinds of obvious wrongs beyond the reach of the courts. Also, any wrong has to be within an applicable cause of action, or the legal system won't recognize it. If something falls between the cracks of the existing set of causes of action, legislatures can always cure that by statute, and common law courts can fashion new causes of action on their own. The question is whether the Supreme Court has that kind of common law power, at least where the wrong by government agents arguably implicates the Constitution. In 1971, in Bivens versus six unknown federal narcotics agents, the Supreme Court resoundingly said yes. In 2007, in Wilkie versus Robbins, the Supreme Court answered that question. Wilkie versus Robbins is a very complicated case. It could have produced significant opinions on the substantive scope of the takings clause, on official immunity, on the reach of the Bivens doctrine, and on the meaning of the RICO statute. As it happened, the Supreme Court only wound up addressing the last two questions, and the RICO question only perfunctorily. To understand exactly what was going on, you have to understand a fairly complicated array of facts. Frank Robbins, a resident of Alabama, bought a cattle ranch in Wyoming. The previous owner of the ranch had granted the federal government an easement over one of the roads that ran through the ranch. Government officials, however, stupidly failed to record the easement. So under Wyoming property law, when Robbins recorded his interest, it effectively extinguished the government's easement. Now, the government had a very easy way to get that easement back. It could have bought out Robbins. If he couldn't agree on a negotiated price, the government could simply have condemned an easement using its power of eminent domain, paid just compensation, and that would have been the end of the story. But for whatever reasons, embarrassment or otherwise, and we don't know because there was never a trial, government agents made it their mission in life to get Robbins to grant them the easement free of charge. According to the complaint, which on a motion to dismiss had to be taken as true, in pursuit of that end, government officials employed a bewildering array of tactics, some flagrantly illegal, such as breaking and entering an invasion of privacy, some legal, strict enforcement of permit regulations and trespass laws, and some bordering on the edge, such as inciting neighbors to cause problems and bringing what turned out to be quite insubstantial criminal charges against Robbins. Now, as it happened, Robbins had one sort of remedy or another for virtually all of the ills that he was caused by government officials, ranging from ability to defend yourself in criminal proceedings to seeking administrative and ultimately judicial review of all sorts of adverse administrative decisions to possible state tort actions against government officials for some of the more egregious misconduct. But from the standpoint of someone like Robbins, fighting perhaps one of those battles is realistic. Fighting all of them could take literally millions and millions of dollars. Now, Robbins, as it turns out, had more resources than most, Supposedly, the government officials in question in this case took to referring him to him as the rich SOB from Alabama. But even a rich SOB from Alabama can only go so far. Robbins tried to claim that there was an independent constitutional violation, apart from all of the individual legal wrongs that he claimed, that amounted to an attempt by the federal government to punish him for exercising his rights to private property, his refusal to grant an easement to the government free of charge. The legal question Robbins had to face is, what exactly is his cause of action? Who exactly does he sue? Robbins did not have a straight-up, garden-variety, conventional takings claim under the Fifth Amendment against the United States. The government never actually got the easement. He would have a takings claim if the government had seized the easement and not paid him just compensation. Then he could have sought damages, and that would have been the end of the story. But Robbins was bringing what amounts to a tort action, not against the United States, which was ultimately dismissed as a defendant, but against the individual government agents who, according to Robbins' allegations, overreached in their efforts to try to, in essence, extort the easement out of him. So Robbins brought this action first as a Bivens action directly under the Constitution, a so-called constitutional tort, and secondly, he tried to bring a RICO claim using extortion as the predicate offense. By a 9-0 vote, the Supreme Court rejected the RICO claim on the ground that there can never be extortion when it's the government rather than the government officials in their personal capacities that are the supposed beneficiaries of the extortion. That may or may not be a plausible interpretation of the RICO statute. That's a story for another time. On the Bivens question, however, the result was more interesting. Bivens, recall, was a case in which federal law enforcement officials had essentially broken into the wrong house and arrested the wrong people. There was no dispute that if there was a violation of the Fourth Amendment, then the government officials in question would stand as tort defendants as a matter of state tort law, just like any private citizens. They couldn't claim legal authorization as a shield against tort liability when the Fourth Amendment was violated. That would effectively strip that authorization away. But what if the relevant state tort law didn't provide a cause of action, or didn't provide what the plaintiff regarded as an adequate remedy? Could the Fourth Amendment be used as a sword by the plaintiff, and not merely used to strip away the shield of legal authorization for the defendants? In 1971, the Supreme Court said yes, the Fourth Amendment can itself be a source, a font, of tort law in common law fashion. That was extended in the 1970s to certain Fifth and Eighth Amendment claims as well. But in language that he no doubt later came to regret, Justice Brennan, in his opinion in Bivens, mentioned that there might be certain circumstances in which courts would not exercise this common law-like power to fashion causes of action for tort damages under the Constitution. One was if Congress had provided an alternative remedial scheme designed to replace the creativity of courts. The second was if there were, quote, special factors counseling hesitation, end quote, in the fashioning of these kinds of remedies. Now, exactly what those special factors might have been in the mind of Justice Brennan or his law clerk in 1971, we don't know. We do know that in subsequent years, those special factors counseling hesitation came to include primarily matters involving military discipline. In Wilkie versus Robbins, however, the Supreme Court found those special factors counseling hesitation against creating a new damages action under the Constitution in the difficulty of defining the cause of action. After all, it can often be hard to draw a distinction between overreaching, or, in the extreme case, attempted extortion by government officials, and the normal sort of hard bargaining that would take place between private property owners, and which presumably can take place between a private property owner and the government as well. In the face of that difficulty, 7 justices of the Supreme Court said no to the creation of a new cause of action. In a concurring opinion, Justices Thomas and Scalia repeated a previous position, essentially saying that they think that Bivens was wrongly decided to begin with and should be limited to its narrow facts, should not be extended in any fashion. Justices Stevens and Ginsburg dissented on the Bivens claim. Justice Ginsburg pointed out that the kinds of line-drawing problems, the majority's focus on, well, how will we know whether there is too much overreaching on the part of the government rather than just the right amount, was reminiscent of the kinds of inquiries that courts routinely make in sexual harassment claims, where, after all, the issue is normally whether there is too much unseemly activity going on in the workplace so that it rises to the level of harassment. The question for the future is what Wilkie versus Robbins presages for the future of the Bivens action. Now, Bivens has been on the wane for a quarter century or more. The Bivens action reached its heyday in the late 1970s, and most of the decisions since that time have been limitations or cutbacks. The question is whether Wilkie represents a qualitatively different and larger cutback, essentially giving a victory to the Thomas Scalia this far and no further position. The answer, as usual, particularly with an opinion written by Justice Souter, is only time will tell. The opinion of the majority certainly could be read as a fairly broad-based rejection of the common law authority of courts to fashion novel remedies. After all, if the difficulty of line drawing is a special factor counseling hesitation within the meaning of the Bivens line of cases, almost anything could meet that standard in the right circumstances. An alternative possibility, however, is that this was a highly fact-bound decision, really turning on the difficulty of defining the right lines to be drawn in this particular case. As an original matter, the case may be closer than Justices Thomas and Scalia led on. After all, the sole power granted to the federal courts is the judicial power. It's not bizarre to understand the judicial power to include the power to fashion remedies. Indeed, it may be a more interesting question than modern law supposes, the extent to which Congress is capable of controlling that power. If there really is a constitutional violation going on, Bivens may not be quite as far out as it may seem at first glance. That would then raise the quite difficult question whether Robbins actually could allege a constitutional violation. Does harassment by government agents for the purpose of punishing someone for exercising a constitutional right itself constitute a substantive violation of the Constitution? The court in Wilkie never had to face that question, and if the case is given a broad interpretation in the future, it probably never will.